Yo, Truth About Markets, 104.4 in London. What's happening, Stacey?
Max Kaiser, it's been a big week. I guess they called elections since we were last here on Resonance 104.4 FM. There's going to be an election May 6th.
Oh, yeah. I see that George Soros was bleating on about how he thinks that the pound must be devalued.
Are you serious? I didn't see that.
Yeah, I saw it on Bloomberg this morning.
Uh-huh.
You know, they've got too much debt, and he's talking about pound devaluation. So this theme of currency devaluation is quite big and getting bigger because during the 2008 and 9 period, all of the investment banks around the world that had loaned into existence many hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars worth of fiat debt, after they got the terms under which they got bailed out was that they transferred their toxic debts to the balance sheets of various sovereign nations, whether it's the UK, the US, the Eurozone, etc. Now these toxic debts, of course, they're not being paid. They're not going to be paid. So people are selling off these markets. And of course, we've already seen it in Iceland. And the past week now, of course, the country that's having its sovereign debt destroyed is Greece. And pretty much as we described, the events unfolding is how they are unfolding. So, but that's the big theme is currency devaluation. Everyone wants to inflate their way out of having to pay back the debt. Nobody actually wants to pay back the debt. And the debts are not going to be paid. And that's a big theme.
Well, I see that Timothy Geithner, I guess, is in China, mm-hmm. where he's having a meeting with the vice premier about revaluing the Chinese currency, China's currency.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy during these times because that's going to drive prices up for Americans.
Yeah, that's right. The currency issue in China is an interesting one. Of course, China just posted their first trade surplus in a long time, in many months. So they're actually exporting more than their...
I mean, the opposite way, their trade deficit. They imported quite a lot.
Yeah, they imported more than they exported. So, which would put the kibosh.
So therefore they would have an incentive now to revalue their currency up. But because Americans, it's not, you know, they couldn't change into a manufacturing country overnight. Most of their goods come from China. So for the average U.S. consumer, if the Chinese yuan goes up, rises in value, then it's going to be very expensive. Costs will increase. Prices will increase for Americans.
Right. That's right. And the two countries seem locked into a relationship that is based on a lot of behind-the-scenes manipulations. And, of course, we don't know the whole picture. We can only... The only real arbiter in all this is the price of gold, which of course continues to go up and make new highs in euro terms and in British pound terms. I mean, obviously the fraud is not tricking the gold vigilantes, on this China U.S. relationship going on now. So China, it's really China versus Walmart, isn't it? And I see Walmart just lowered the price on 10,000 items.
Yeah, that's correct. But it seems like it would be a win-win situation for China because all their goods that they have to buy, the iron ore prices, remember those just nearly doubled, but they're priced in dollars.
Yeah.
The price of gas, of oil is now at, what, $86 a barrel?
Right. The rising Chinese currency makes it cheaper for China to buy the raw commodities.
That's correct. So they could, you know, if they felt like revaluing, I don't know how much they're going to revalue, but it looks like they are. Some say up to 30%. Mish, on the other hand, says it will crash, but some say it'll increase by up to 30%, that it's 30% undervalued. So their goods, their cost of oil and iron ore would then fall by 30%.
Right, right. The case for move down, I guess, is related to the huge real estate bubble, because they've built all these cities with thousands and tens of thousands of units that are right at the moment empty. So this would presage a weaker currency. The relationship, again, between the world's biggest debtor and the world's biggest creditor, between the world's biggest consumer and the world's cheapest labor, is the key relationship. And it gives rise to the blob. There's a big blob, an economic blob, in the global economy that's expanding. And it's pushing the poor people down, and it's pushing the rich people up. So, for example, in the United States, the wealth gap is widening, and it's captured by the Gini index, the Gini coefficient index, which shows the wealth and inequality gap. And the U.S. is on par with Uruguay at the moment, and it's getting worse and worse, because the blob that's fed, it's a political economic blob that is amorphous, and it's non-transparent, it's part of the shadow banking system, it's part of crooked deals, it's part of political corruption. It's just this blob that is fed and getting bigger, that's forcing the wealthy higher, and the poorer are going lower. So to anyone who is interested in any notion of social justice, would have to drain the blob in some way. I mean, that would be the goal, but it's very, very difficult to do so, because it's by nature, by definition, almost impossible to define. It's hidden behind many, many layers of accounting fraud. It's hidden behind many bribes and payola and scams, and you can try to point your finger at it, but it's the invisible antimatter, the blob that is. I mean, I can talk about it and explain it, and we've mentioned it on the show in one way or another. It's not inflation or deflation; it's blobflation. You know, it's blobflation that is raking. This is why nobody can decide. I mean, you know, every week there's a story in the Bloomberg press saying Federal Reserve still trying to figure out whether we're experiencing inflation or deflation. They can't even tell you what the flation suffix is plaguing the global economy, because it's neither. It's the blobflation. You know, it's this amorphous swamp of financial goo that's being fed with accounting fraud and easy money. And it's just making the rich richer, so they don't have any incentive to poke the blob, because they're benefiting. And the poor are too busy in their slave jobs to have time off to figure out how to kill the blob.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like what we always talk about. You know, it's medieval. It's a sort of feudal system.
Yeah, it goes back to, you know, we've seen an interesting show on the BBC about the Greek gods from 2,000, 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, like the Cyclops and the Journeys of Odysseus. You know, these huge monsters that were out there in the deep that were mythical creatures. You know, the blobflation is a mythical creature. It's a mythical creature because it has no specific definition. It's a mythical creature that roams the financial multiverse. It's like the Cyclops meets some sea creature meets a god.
The Minotaur
meets the Cyclops, and there is at the moment no Odysseus. There's no Hercules. You know, there's nobody. There's no heroes that we have no heroes. We have ersatz, fake heroes on the silver screen fighting virtual monsters in 3D. But we have no real heroes fighting blobflation in the miasma of the financial swamp.
Now that I think about it, Tim Geithner kind of looks like the Minotaur, and Ben Bernanke's the Cyclops.
Well, yeah. Plus, Geithner, he kind of looks like one of those guys, Beavis and Butthead. I don't know which one, Beavis or Butthead, but the one with the long head and the crinkly eyebrows. I think that might be Beavis.
But speaking of Minotaurs and Cyclops, I see in the UK, you know, I know you said George Soros says that the pound should be devalued.
Yeah.
Well, obviously they're doing it. They're trying their best to do that.
Right.
Like he's just pointing out the obvious, because the British people and the British government have so much debt. The banks, of course, have no debt because they transferred it to the British people.
Right.
But gold has hit an all-time high on Friday in the pound.
Yeah, you see, Britain would love to devalue the pound to help their export markets. You know, what's left of it, their manufacturing, you know, what little is left. I mean, it would be helpful. But, you see, they're so friendly to oligarchs and mafia chieftains and all kinds of espionage crooks and, you know, financial and political terrorists that the money keeps pouring in.
Yeah, but obviously the pound is devaluing if gold has hit a new all-time high in the British pound, sterling.
Yeah. Well, it would be a lot lower if it weren't for all the money flooding into Britain from the world's most heinous financial and political terrorists,
mm-hmm.
who use Britain as their chief money laundering capital, of course. But if you strip that out, I mean, if you strip money laundering out of Britain's, you know, we did the show for Russia Today last week, and we were talking about Citigroup, and I did that search on Google, which was revealing, I thought. If you type in Citibank plus money laundering, it came back with 92,000 references.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be on, I think, Tuesday's episode.
Yeah, and just reading the first two or three entries, it's Citigroup thrown out of Japan for money laundering. Citigroup caught money laundering Mexican drug cartel money. You know, it just goes on and on and on and on. Then you look at the Financial Times here from last week, some date, April 9th.
That's yesterday.
Friday, April 9th, yesterday.
Yeah.
In the big story front page, ex-city chiefs say sorry for loan losses. Chuck Prince, who we've covered on the show for years, everyone knows he's actually the true head of Al-Qaeda. And Bob Rubin, who was also very active in the higher-ups in Al-Qaeda, they deny risk management problems. The congressional panel hits out on out at executives. Now, the congressional panel has no ability, no leverage, no stick in which to impose any kind of penalties. So you have this guy like Chuck Prince and Bob Rubin come up there and very slizzardly they just talk drivel. There's no, you know, it's atrocious. But anyway, so Chuck Prince, you know, one of their big thesis here, one of their statements is that they, you know, they had no idea that the crash was coming in all these products.
Yeah, they keep saying that over and over. And by the way, first of all, the headline is wrong. It says ex-city chiefs, implying that both Chuck Prince and Robert Rubin said sorry, because the fact is Robert Rubin refused to apologize. Chuck Prince started off his 5-minute statement with saying, first of all, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the disaster that has befallen the world economy. Robert Rubin refused to apologize.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these are the guys we've been talking about for years now. I mean, the fact, you know, I mean, so they, I don't know why did they even question them in front of Congress? What was the point of that?
Oh, it's just it's show trials. But one of the things that Chuck Prince says, I can only say that I am deeply sorry that our management, starting with me, was not more prescient and that we did not foresee what lay before us. So he's acting as if, like, we're sorry that we're not like magical, you know, oracles who could have seen the future, that mm-hmm. it wasn't possible to see this. He uses words like that, prescient and things like that. Whereas the fact is they knew what was coming because they engineered it. They created the fraud. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I'm so sorry that my fraudulent medicine I sold to you that is just like some water with a bit of, you know, roses sprinkled in it. I'm so sorry it didn't treat your cancer. I had no idea. I wasn't prescient. I wasn't able to see that.
Yeah. I mean, this is the defense that should be attempted by arsonists. You know, I mean, I threw the gasoline-soaked rag into the house, and I lit it. But I wasn't prescient enough to understand that it would burn the house down and I would get paid a $1 billion package from the insurance company.
That's right. Well, these are the modern-day snake oil salesmen. America's always had these sort of people traveling around selling stuff.
They're burning down the banking system and getting paid the insurance. Now, how is that different than the mob busting out, you know, dry cleaners that they've stolen all the money from, or some restaurant they've stolen all the money from? You know, there's that scene in, you know, Scorsese's film about the mafia.
Mean Streets?
No.
Godfather? Oh, no, that's...
No, the one with Robert De Niro and...
So here's another one. Here's another quote from Chuck Prince. Almost all of us involved in the financial system missed the powerful combination of forces at work and the serious possibility of a financial crisis. So again, like using these magical terms, like these forces, the all-knowing market, we had no idea that the market would turn against us. It goes back to your Greek mythology thing where people just explain things through cyclops and giant cannibals and minotaurs. And we had no idea there was a minotaur inside the algorithm upon which we traded collateralized debt obligations.
They burnt down the system and they collected the insurance. Was it a casino, the movie? You know, and
there was a casino. Chris Scorsese made it with Sharon Stone and Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro were in it.
Uh-huh.
The gangs Ray of
Liotta.
New York.
Ray Liotta. He says he always wanted to be a gangster, and that's the way the film opens. I knew I always wanted to be a gangster. And they have a great series of scenes in there where they bust out the restaurant. You know, they go down there and they burn it down and they collect the insurance. It's the mafia. They take over the restaurant, they bleed it dry of all the money and all the loans, and they default on the loans, and they collect the insurance. Now, Chuck Prince used Citigroup to leverage up the balance sheet, pay himself millions, hundreds of millions, and then burnt down the bank. So did Bob Rubin. They're financial arsonists. Now they go to Congress and they say, we're sorry. So how come they get to use that defense that they didn't understand that if you throw a Molotov cocktail into a car and set it on fire that it blows up? Well, how come they get to use that defense?
Well, there's a trend for these sort of truth and reconciliation commissions that have all you have to do is admit you're sorry, say oops, and now the rest of society has to move on.
Well.
Unfortunately, Americans, because of the 2005 law, which Chuck Prince and Robert Rubin would have been actively involved in getting this law passed, Americans themselves can't just say, oops, sorry, I racked up $100,000 in debt on my credit card. Oops, can't pay it. Bye. You know, they have that indentured slavery, you know, indentured servitude law now. Basically,
yeah, right.
Basically, it's very difficult to get out of...
Why can't you just say I racked up $100,000 on my Visa card? I wasn't prescient enough to know that it would result in my bankruptcy.
Exactly. Why aren't Americans just saying that? I couldn't have foreseen the circumstance.
Well, then you got these congressional panel...
It's like one of these... You know, the UK was really the one that... reintroduce these back into society. They're very fantastic here at all these, you know, whitewash commissions.
Yeah.
The Hutton Report sort of stuff. You know, they have no teeth. There's nothing. Nobody's going to end up in jail. Nobody's going to be fine. It's just like, oops, let's get kind of a fake story out.
Yeah, but also it's interesting. I guess I was surprised to see this because I thought this whole chapter was finished. I mean, they're not going to retry Bernie Madoff. I mean, he stole all the money. He's in jail. The Citigroup stole all the money, and they got away with it. They're not. Why are they continuing on with this? It's over. It ended. When Barack Obama kept Geithner and Summers in their jobs and gave Wall Street a blank check, that there was nothing else to report. It's over. You had your money stolen. Move on. Nothing to see here, right?
Well, I would think it's because midterm elections are coming up, and they want to be able to say, you know, in people's minds, they're going to see these guys in front of Congress and they're going to think some sort of justice was done. Punishment was, you know, handed out.
I know. You're right. They're going to send every voting American a $10 gift certificate to Walmart. as a result of these trials. And everyone will say, see, we got our justice.
Wow, that's another zombie story. Hollywood Top Guns take a shot at reviving debt-ridden MGM. Nobody will let that thing die.
Mm-hmm.
Every single... I mean, that has been the same headline since when I was working in L.A., 1992. You know, people were... Somebody's always buying MGM and flogging it with more debt and then trying to revive it and trying to get the dead horse up.
Well, the business model is shot. You know, I mean, it's something. So anyway, Tony and Sir Ridley Scott, they've emerged as surprise contenders. They're a couple of British types.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, all roads lead to London lead to some sort of fraud and money laundering scheme.
Yeah, the DVD market is crashing because people get their films and TV online. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
The whole idea of having a catalog of movies is is just not the business model anymore. Now, of course, on the other side of the coin, you had that very troubling story last week that the FCC is going to allow Comcast to go forward and create a two-tier internet, basically, which will push out access to sites that are not part of the pay-per-view scheme. So they're trying to turn the internet into the same model that you find for cable TV. You pay $20, $30, $40, $50 a month, depending on the package of content you want from the internet. Comcast had a major victory. The FCC was unsuccessful in defending the rights of the internet. And all of the independent media that's been on the internet, sites like, let's say, democracynow.org, to try to get that going forward, it'll be relegated to much slower networks. And it may be a lot more difficult to download a show like that, for example. And this, of course, would revive the value of these back catalogs of these studios, because now if the internet's going to become just like cable TV and it's going to be a digital right management gulag, then yeah, maybe the value of these back catalogs. But, you know, unfortunately, these folks have pressured the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, to lobby in Washington to really dumb down the internet. You know, broadband speeds are very slow in the U.S. to service the needs of Hollywood and the MPAA. And meanwhile, the rest of the world is zooming ahead, it appears to me. You know, the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot here.
Yeah, well, America's down into the 30s in terms of nations, the penetration of broadband. We have that problem all the time when we have to do Skype video interviews for our television shows.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get any American guests on Skype video unless they have super fast broadband speeds that they have the special T2 sort of lines.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only people we can really interview.
And of course,
But the Comcast thing is the FCC actually ruled that that they had to provide net neutrality, that they had to provide equal access to all websites, regardless of who they were, and all users of the site, of the internet. Mm-hmm. But it was a federal judge who overruled the FCC and said the FCC is not allowed to regulate on that sort of issue.
Right. That's right. Well, so isn't the FCC the regulator?
Yes.
Okay. So
a judge said it was discriminatory towards these corporations, that they should be able to discriminate. They should be able to charge more for faster speeds.
Uh-huh. Right. So the judge is in the pocket of the copyright industry?
Well, exactly. Or maybe...
This judge anyway? It wasn't a Supreme Court judge. It was some other...
It was a federal judge.
Federal judge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But... You know, it could be the case, like, remember when the Department of Justice allegedly tried to take on, tried to sue those Blackwater guards for crimes
mm-hmm.
against the Nisar Square massacre.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually, the judge threw out the case because the Department of Justice, incorrectly, they made some sort of deal with the defendants, and then that threw out the entire case. But they knew mm-hmm. what they were doing. But they pretend that they're actually trying the case. So maybe the FCC, maybe they just didn't present a good enough case in court, maybe intentionally. It's hard. You know, these are the sort of things that you argue with the Cantor exchange. It's hard to say whether it's going to be hard to say whether Julia Roberts, for example, throws her performance. It's hard to say whether the FCC threw their performance in court.
Right. Now, doesn't this go back to the Bush administration when he put in all these federal judges at some like Christmas Eve or something? Or he fired a whole bunch of federal judges?
Yeah, Karl Rove did. That's because they were refusing to find, you know, they were trying to say that black people registering to vote was somehow was fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guy in particular in New Mexico, the attorney general there, he looked at the cases that Karl Rove forced him to look at, and he couldn't find any evidence of voter fraud.
So what do we know about these federal judges exactly? I don't really know much about it. Is there a national panel of federal judges?
Well, the presidents appoint them.
So it's not the Supreme Court. That's the Supreme Court. And then they have, like, if you go to the New York City and there's a judge who's down there at the courthouse, and he's a municipal judge. And
so I don't know what level. There are all sorts of appellate courts and, you know, various levels of federal courts. The FCC could respond to this with, you know, they could challenge this ruling and take mm-hmm. it to another level of court. And it could, ultimately, it could end up in the Supreme Court.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the federal judges, you keep hearing it in instances where civil rights are being thwarted, and even now regulators are being thwarted. So these judges are overriding regulators. Again, why have regulators? I mean, I don't understand what.
Yeah, but this is what across the whole board, the entire board. There is a reason why you put, you know, former lobbyists for Monsanto into, you know, federal judgeships or become Supreme Court members or are your attorney general.
Yeah.
It's one and the same thing. You're so tied to this notion that America is somehow this democracy. You really still get so upset, but you have to move on. It's whatever the corporations want, whatever a few ruling elites want, that's what they get. And if a regulatory body gets in the way, well, then we have to disband them. If they actually tried to exercise their authority, then we have to disband them, get rid of them.
Yeah, no, I get it. I'm just, you know, I'm as anxious to bribe a judge as anybody. I'm just trying to figure out who.
Well, you're not allowed to. You're.
But apparently, you can, according to this story.
No, you have to be the right sort of person.
I mean, can I do a backdoor thing? I mean, I don't have to. It doesn't have to be Max Kaiser. It could be a consortium, like a hedge fund or something. A consortium, and we approach the judge on grounds.
No, we normal people are only allowed to bribe policemen, and like. Local politicians.
You can't
bribe at the federal level unless you're connected politically.
Or a foreign government.
Yeah, foreign government or connected politically.
Okay. Well, that's too bad. Well, let's see. What else we got here? So, City and Bob and, I mean, Prince and Bob Rubin. Where is he? I wonder where he'll go next. He'll probably open up a hedge fund or something. We got.
I'm sure he's on the board of directors of many companies, collecting, you know, $1 million here, $1 million there, $4 million there.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see what else. What else we got here in this cavalcade of crime? Well, of course, the Greek economy is going to be sacrificed on the altar of neoliberalism. I guess this is the news here is that this is the first time a Western European country is going to go the way of some of these other countries that have been sacrificed on the altar of neoliberalism. So That's kind of interesting, I suppose, 'cause so the forces of neoliberal debt enslavement are creeping ever closer to the center of the axis of consumers.
Well, we've already seen this story. We've seen it played out once before in world history, recent world history. I'm sure it's been done many times, but when you try to force people to pay an entire nation to pay debts that are impossible to pay, they find somebody who will, sometimes it turns out ugly.
They need a
Just,
hero.
well, they need a, well, they look for a strong man.
Like Odysseus.
Or Hitler. They look for somebody, Germany was a normal middle class economy. Then they got saddled with these debts for a fake war, World War I. And they had debts suddenly that they couldn't possibly pay. And that was when it was real money. And look what happened. They looked for somebody who was willing to drive out, who was willing to repudiate the debt.
That's right. Now, what's happening in one of those Stan countries? There's a big revolt. You sent me the link this morning.
It's right on the front page of here, Kyrgyzstan.
Oh yeah. Let's talk about Kyrgyzstan. What's
I haven't
going
had
on?
a chance to really look into it, so I don't know what's going on. I know that the U.S. has just returned there only what, 8 months ago, 10 months ago. They were kicked out by the previous government, who forced the U.S. out. I guess they were close to Moscow, and the U.S. was using this base for all their invasions of that region. And now these guys who were in power let the U.S. back in, and they. I don't know. Now there was another revolution going on. Apparently, the headlines this morning were reading that the new government, interim government, says there's only $80 million left in the public coffers.
Right, that was the big point, isn't it? They only there's only 80 billion left.
80 million with an
I'm
M.
sorry, 80 million
80
left.
million dollars,
Wow.
and that the it looks like all the, billions disappeared to the family that was running the country before. Now, the Obama administration is staying aloof. They said they're not taking sides in this.
No.
Here's a case where they don't seem to care where there's a violent overthrow. Who knows? I have to research it more. But obviously, it's nothing as it seems.
Right. Well, getting back to your strongman, rise of a strongman, what seems to be interesting at this point in history is that you've got, because of globalization, if you took Iceland and Ireland and Greece and Kazakhstan and these other countries, they're all suffering from the same problem of the blobflation, destroying their economies. So the response. The thing that would be different from, let's say, what happened in the 30s in Germany, the response would be more of a global response. I mean, that's kind of an interesting idea. So the global response could take different forms, and it could mean different things. I don't. That's what I'm thinking. I don't think this is going to be just one region or one country is going to seek regime change, in the way that we've seen in the past. I think it's going to be a global effort from this global community of the dispossessed and disenfranchised who
Well,
will somehow fight back.
we have the opposite problem. We have soft men. All the leaders of most Western democracies that I could think of are soft men. They're the bag men for these banks and a few major corporations, a few major monopolies. So they're the soft men for them, and they've transferred trillions and trillions in wealth from the taxpayer to them. There's no point in any democracy that right now I can think of that you're always presented with just basically two options of soft and softer. Those are the two options. They're both candidates, both parties are going to hand even more to those guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's take the example of an online hard man, WikiLeaks.org. Okay, it's a global repository for evidence to fight back against blobflation. And WikiLeaks.org has leapfrogged ahead of the media. They've done in 3 years or 3 months what it took the Washington Post 30 years to collect in terms of breaking stories, uncovering fraud and malpractice and things of this nature. So the WikiLeaks.org, is that the tip of the spear? Is that
Yeah, but you're talking about the internet, which is like global capital and global elite and global rich people and global corporations and global capital. It's stateless. We human in the meat space have to you're not allowed to be stateless, actually. Like you can't go renounce your citizenship unless you have citizenship, a passport with another nation. So you're stuck with one nation that you have to become a member of. You're not allowed to just be, stateless.
Okay, well,
You're not allowed to reject all of them.
WikiLeaks is aligning itself with Iceland, for example. And Iceland has said recently that they want to become the only country in the world to offer safe harbor for journalists.
Yes.
Now, let's say Iceland becomes the new America in some degree, to some extent. And they only have 300,000 people live there. And let's say another 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000 migrate to Iceland, whose purpose is to pursue a dream of press freedom and speech freedom. So there's a state that would have the potential to draw in huge resources based on a constitution that was dedicated toward speech rights and press rights. I mean, is Iceland the tip of the spear?
Well, it could almost be like a practice run for settling the moon, because it kind of it's a moonscape. If you've ever driven across the country, it's totally deserted and desolate. You could drive for hours with just like seeing nothing, but it looks like the moon.
You see, Iceland, of course, is entangled up with a problem that they got trapped in a IMF, trap where they've been trying to pressure by the Netherlands and the UK for billions of dollars worth of loans that the people there had nothing to do with, and they voted no. 93% of the people voted no. And they're going to keep this in mind. They're not going to pay back these loans. So this is what is as a way to boost the Icelandic economy now, to be competitive. I think the next move for Iceland would be to get rid of all those aluminum smelter companies, like Alcoa, for example. They should throw those companies out, and they should figure out ways to monetize their geothermal resources in ways that would equal or surpass the income that they get from the aluminum smelters. And they should have a program like, remember in America where they had that westward movement, what do they call that there? People can go west and they get some land plots. They get some land, the land rush of the 19th century. Why doesn't Iceland offer the global free speech advocate citizens of the world an incentive to move to Iceland? You get 20 years of free internet access or something. I would move there if they gave me a deal like this.
Free internet access?
Yeah, 20 years of broadband, high-speed broadband, and some other perks similar. I would move, and go to Iceland and be part of a new America Part Two. The Icelandic constitution should be rewritten. And they should take control of their resources. They should not give up their fishing grounds to the Eurozone. They already won the Cod Wars of the 1970s with Britain. They've got smart, young, perky politicians like Brigitte that we've interviewed on our show a couple of times, and we're going to interview her again.
This week, because their own Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report comes out on Monday.
And you know, why not get thoroughly behind Iceland? You know, their political class needs to be reconstructed. Get rid of all the weak hands and the whiners and the turncoats. Get rid of the smelting companies, the aluminum smelting companies. They're only fouling the environment anyway. And go back into the global banking system, but use with the agenda of a different agenda. You've already proven that Icelandic people, based on their heritage of being fishing experts, you know what, you know, all hedge fund is, they're just professional fishermen looking for fish out there in the global sea of opportunity. You know, Iceland took that scale and applied it to their own economy, and they were for a couple of years there big winners. Then they let the sharks in from Lehman and Wall Street, and they had a controlled demolition. They made out with billions. They should also, as part of the new constitution.
It's Bear Stearns. You always say it was Lehman, but it was Bear Stearns who shorted the country's currency and took it down.
Yeah. And as part of the new constitution, they should go after the bankers that were responsible for the looting. They should seek them out. I mean, you know, it's just like the Nazi hunters, you know. They roam the world looking for Nazis who committed atrocities. Why can't Iceland have the banker hunters that go around the world looking for bankers who committed banking atrocities? Bring them to justice, you see? And Iceland could be the tip of the spear as far as a new place that will carry the torch of speech rights.
Well, you know, up in Iceland, whenever you construct any new building or office or anything, house, you have to get a government approval that there are no little people there. But
you're talking about the elves and the
they call them little people. I don't know, you could call them elves.
They're little wizards or something.
No, they call them little people. That's what they call them, little people.
Well, the connotation here could be a midget.
Well, I'm just telling you that the Icelandic people call these people little people.
Mm-hmm. But it's very generous of them to call these little gnomes little people when apparently they're just little spirits or something.
Okay, Max is calling them whatever he wants to call them, but I'm saying in Iceland they have this notion that there's little people out there. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this, it was revealed on Friday, this evidence of, well, they found the skull, a whole skeleton of this little person, 2 million years old. Mm-hmm. And maybe they still live in Iceland and that we're just making fun of Icelandic people for their little people thing. And we really do have this ancient hominid walking around in Iceland somewhere. It's hard to tell because it's such a lot of massive empty space there.
Yeah. Well, the history of the little people is important in Iceland, and in the new constitution there would be provisions for maintaining integrity of the fan club in Reykjavik and elsewhere in Iceland for the little people. There's a, I guess it's kind of a religious cult to some degree.
Well, it says that they were 1.3 meters tall, so I guess about 3 feet.
Where do they find these little people?
These were in South Africa.
Oh, okay.
Where almost all other humans, Homo species, evolved.
Mm-hmm. So that's right.
They found two of these skeletons, a woman, an adult female, and a juvenile male. The new species, described in the Journal of Science, displays a mixture of ape-like and human-like features. It has arms as long as an orangutan's, but short, powerful hands, an advanced pelvis, and long legs like a human, which would have enabled bipedal walking and possibly even running. So, I'm just curious. Like, we also found those Homo habilis skeletons recently in Indonesia. And they coexist with the humans for quite a while.
Right, right. So the original split with the monkeys, the chimps, happened 6 million years ago, apparently.
Yeah.
And since that time, there's been many offshoots of humanoid-like species.
Humanoid? Hominid, yeah.
And Homo sapiens, our tribe, they appeared on the scene
200,000 years ago.
Just 200,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's so recent.
That's right. But they had always been missing. This is what they say might be the missing link, because this is a 2-million-year-old skeleton. This is the oldest species they found.
They're filling in the gaps.
They're getting closer and closer to the common ancestor, to the chimp. Like, so the very earliest walking beings.
Joey. Joey, the walking being.
Maybe that was his name.
He stood up on both legs and realized that he was aching for a Krispy Kreme donut, and thus began the history of the human experience on planet Earth.
So there is an election here in the UK.
Yeah.
That's going to be held. What do you think is going to go on? More of the same old stuff?
What's going to happen? It's, you mean the results?
So Gordon Brown is, the Labour Party is increasing, is closing the gap between the poll numbers with the Tories, the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
And part of the reason, a major part of the reason, as we discussed on our show, is that if, the Tories want to introduce austerity measures in order to cut the debt. You know, the UK has one of the highest debt levels in the world.
Yes.
But I see that so far I haven't seen any mention of bankers or any role of bankers, or we need to, you know, prevent bankers from destroying our economy. Should we dare to fix it? Well, so, like, what's the point of fixing your economy and reducing the debt if that just gives an opportunity for bankers to plunder it again?
Well, this is exactly right. You know, there's an old saying on Wall Street, shear, never slaughter. And the fact that these markets have come back is another opportunity to shear the public. They didn't allow them to get slaughtered back in 2008. They restored them by giving them a massive credit transfusion. And now they're ready to be sheared again. Now, when the markets tumble, and the banks in particular tumble again, this will be referred to as a new crisis, instead of a continuation of the existing crisis. And the people who will be responsible in solving the new crisis will be the same people who gave us the previous crisis, but they will say that they solved the previous crisis because, after all, the stock market went up and it proved that they knew what they were doing, and therefore they're the ones who should be in place now to solve the current crisis that's coming when the banks collapse again in the next, you know, 2 or 3 months. And this is just a recycle that's repeated over and over again. And meanwhile, the blobflation keeps growing, pushing the top higher and the bottom lower. And unless you're willing to lance the blobflation and to drain it of the blobflation pus, there's nothing to... The election results, in other words, yes, it'll be more of the same, because nobody on either side is talking about lancing the blobflation and draining the system of its financial pus.
Well, you know, you often hear of families who have an addict in the family, like a heroin addict or a gambling addict, and the family is torn apart constantly because, of course, the addict will steal any cash that, say, the mother has in the purse, or they'll sell the furniture in order to make money to get another hit. And so, of course, the family learns not to have any cash or have anything of value in the house ever again.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what we're at now in the Western economies, is if you decide to try to rebuild your pension funds, rebuild your economy, is it just going to be plundered again by the addicts?
Yeah. You know, and the addicts are closing in on all of those bank accounts that people have outside of their various countries of residence. You know, there's a lot more initiatives now in the U.S. and the U.K. and around the world to expand the surveillance capability of various tax authorities to close in on anybody's attempt to put money safely aside from the blobflation meisters. But of course they can't cover it all. Some of that money is leaking into the gold bullion market,
which is indicting Gordon Brown. And I see on the front page of the Financial Times, Gordon Brown, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, promised U.S.-style fixed-term parliaments as part of sweeping constitutional and electoral reforms if he wins the general election. You know, I've been hearing this. I moved to London in 1994.
Yes.
And every single time there's an election, I hear that Labour's going to introduce constitutional reform. They're going to introduce a constitution in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's never been done. But it seems to work that every single election time they tell the people that they're going to do this. And
see, in the UK never had a proper revolutionary break. They had a bend. They got bent. You know, like Henry VIII kind of bent the society, you know, away from the Rome toward the Church of England and introduced all kinds of, what do you call it there? Secular trends. And then there was another attempt at some break during, who was it, Cromwell?
Something like that, yeah. So yeah, so this is what he's going to do. He says he's going to introduce parliamentary limits, so unlike the U.S. He said that if elected, he would ensure that Britain, like the U.S., has a national parliament that meets for a fixed term. This would replace the current system whereby the prime minister of the day has the power to determine at any moment when a general election is called. Mr. Brown said Labour would press ahead with replacing the House of Lords, the UK Parliament's appointed upper chamber. This has been promised for years. With a body whose members are directly elected under proportional representation. He said he would abolish the right of a small number of hereditary peers, lords by birth, to sit and vote in the body. He also announced that he would call a referendum before October 2011 on changes to the first-past-the-post of electoral system for the Westminster Parliament. Yeah, so of course he's going to change that after this election, because the first-past-the-post is the thing that really kind of skews.
What does past the post mean?
Well, it's basically, it's not proportional representation here.
Uh-huh.
In the UK. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, you can even have like somebody actually win more of the popular vote, but in terms of numbers, but it depends on the region and blah, blah, blah. So it'll, you know, you could have a disproportionate size of the Labour representation in Parliament.
Right, right. And how are my favorite party, the Lib Dems, doing?
They're your favorite party?
Yes, they have Vince Cable, who's the only one in Parliament down there in Whitehall who actually knows anything about economics. And they've got great sex scandals. They got some new lesbian MP. A porn woman who made the softcore porno. She's a representative in the Lib Dems. I mean, what more could you want? Vince Cable and soft porn. I mean, that's the party I would be voting for if I voted in the election over there.
Well, it depends. So it depends on how close, if neither party, conservatives or Labour, have an absolute majority, then Labour could theoretically, Gordon Brown theoretically could remain prime minister if they form an alliance with Lib Dems.
Well, Gordon Brown just seems like, you know, he just seems more like a prime minister of Britain. He has the look of it, you know, some guy who wears shoes on the beach, you know, that type of thing. You know, David Cameron just seems like he should be running a health food store in Notting Hill or something. I mean, and just talking down to people about why they should be eating organic food and going with the huskies up there in the tundra. He has no gravitas.
But also
gravitas.
You know, but at this point as well, you know, the conservatives are likely to try to prove something to like accelerate change or do something crazy once they get into power. And, you know, every party seems to get into power saying they're going to undo all the harm the previous one did. And then as soon as they get into power, I guess they're met by the economic hitmen sort of guys. And then they actually accelerate all the bad stuff.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So I think we should just have dictators. Or king. Let the queen run the country.
Yeah, well, does she have the option to say, I'm not happy with either of these choices. I'm taking over. I'm exerting my monarchy.
Well, she did dissolve the parliament, okay, because that's what she has to do.
She has to do it at the end, right, and then reconstitute it?
Yeah, well, so it's dissolved now.
So why can't she just fail to reconstitute it?
That's what I'm saying. Maybe she should just say, forget it.
Just say, we're not reconstituting this time.
Well, you need the help of the people. So if nobody, not one single person, shows up on May 6th to cast a vote for a new parliament,
right,
a new government.
The queen steps in.
The queen will say, oops, there's no government, so I'll have to run.
Then who's the number two guy? The Duke of Windsor?
The Prince Charles.
No, you know, who's she married to? The Duke of Windsor.
No, the Duke of Edinburgh.
The man who makes all the faux pas all the time.
The Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip.
That guy's cool. He's constantly making those politically incorrect comments in the major media. He doesn't really care, does he? I say you get him in number 10 Downing Street. He'd just make all these ridiculous... He'd be like the new... who is Two Jabs, that guy? Two Jags?
Prescott.
Prescott. He'd be even more like Prescott than Prescott, making all these ridiculous comments all the time. The press would be fawning over him. And also, Boris Johnson, you need to get him out of this ridiculous job as mayor because he's gone undercover. Who ever hears about Boris Johnson anymore?
I know, he's too polite. He's always having to, like, not say anything crazy.
His whole career has been, you know, was built on outraging people with ridiculous comments, and it's been a no-show. What kind of career is that? Nothing.
Okay, well, that's it for this week's Truth About Markets.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, before we go in our last minute, I did want to mention, memorialize the passing of Malcolm McLaren. And the entrepreneur, impresario behind the Sex Pistols. And that's all I have to say about that. Bye, y'all!